Welcome to Nosecast. Homilies delivered in the Holy Gnosis of Thomas Chapel, the Ecclesia Gnostica, in Salt Lake City, Utah, by the Reverend Troy Pierce.
Today we celebrate a saint who is quite dear to me, Holy Francis of Assisi. And it isn't perhaps obvious why Gnostics would include him in their calendar of saints, their holy days. He was, after all, a Roman Catholic saint, founder of a Roman Catholic order, and never sought to dispute issues of doctrine or to espouse ideas that were connected with Gnostic mythology or the Gnostic worldview. But Francis is a universal saint in so many ways. His story is one that has been told for centuries in Buddhist circles. He's a Buddhist saint as well. Name was changed slightly, but the story is very recognizably that of Francis. And it makes perfect sense in a Buddhist context. Francis was a rather romantic figure as a very young man. His father was a merchant of cloth, and this took him into the south of France quite frequently. And this very same time was a bit before the Albigensian Crusade, during the time of great Cathar movement and revival that took place in the south of France, along the Rhine, and also the north of Italy, where Umbria, where Assisi is to be found. So there is this connection with the Cathars, perhaps, around the area where Francis lived, and also along this trade route that Francis's father traveled. And indeed, in the south of France, there were a number of robber barons, lords who charged excessive tolls or took what they wanted. And it was really the Cathar missionaries that went through and converted so many of these people that these trade routes became safe. They no longer took anything from traders such as Francis's father and made trading much more lucrative. So the wealth, the atmosphere, and a lot of these notions were tied in with what Francis was living in, the whole atmosphere he lived in. Francis was also very enamored with the songs of the troubadours. And the troubadours arose in the south of France, same time as the Cathar influence, and they also had a love of mysticism, and there's a lot of connections one can weave there. They were also prized by lords who had converted to Catharism. Whether or not there is a direct inspiration of the troubadours in Cathar faith or not is subject to speculation. There certainly is a link that is a very historical link and isn't subject to speculation. And so this also influenced Francis throughout his life. As a young man, his dreams were those of the troubadour songs, to be a knight, to go off into glorious battle and so forth. And he was a very charismatic young man. He had friends among the highest class of citizens. It's very class conscious, much like our own age, but we pretend ours isn't. And he had all these social connections. He would feast and party and use his wealth to the benefit of all these citizen sons in Assisi. He was very well connected. When war broke out, he went along. His very romantic notions of war, it's probably the rest of the young men of Assisi had as well. His first time out, he was captured by Perugia, another city-state, held captive with other young men and other soldiers from a city until a ransom deal could be worked out. This was the common practice, that instead of killing somebody, you'd accept money for them instead and ransom them back. And so they spent some time in captivity and said that he got very ill and was close to death and recovered. He seemed to have a fairly similar state that he had before that. At least he still had the same general ambitions. And when another army was called up to go in service of the Pope, he joined up. His father bought him armor, a horse, outfitted him in the best. So he was essentially a knight in the far as the armament he had, the equipment he had, though he wasn't noble. And he went off to join the army. And this is when he started having his dreams. He had a dream that told him that his destiny was other than this. And this dream affected him so deeply that he actually gave his armor and his horse to a poor knight who was a part of the army. Someone who really was a nobleman, had the status of knight, but didn't have the equipment. And Francis gave that to him. He then went back to Assisi. His father was off on one of his many journeys. And he took a bunch of cloth he was supposed to go and sell. He took it, sold it, and then he gave the money, or tried to give the money, to the church. This had disastrous consequences for him, because his father came back, was angry with him. And he had, in the meantime, taken shelter in churches and gone about becoming the Francis that we know. He was spending a lot of time in San Damiano Church praying, and the San Damiano cross is the one there on the wall. And it is of the resurrected Christ. It's not a crucified figure. It's actually quite unusual. And while he was praying, meditating, contemplating, he heard Christ say, "Francis, rebuild my church." He took that to mean that he was supposed to physically rebuild church. And his father, in the meantime, brought a lawsuit against him for the money that he had absconded with when he took the cloth and sold it. And Francis declared that he was under the protection of the church, and so this should be tried before the bishop. So he had essentially become part of the church, become one of the religious in his inner state of being. And so this was brought before the bishop, and his father demanded his money back. And Francis, famously, give you everything back. Give you back my name. I'm no longer your son. And he took off all the clothes that belonged to his father as well and gave them back to him. And the bishop, probably embarrassedly, but also in a way symbolically, then drew his cloak over Francis to cover him. And essentially, at that point, Francis had broken ties with his family and had been received, at least in some sense, into the church. The rest of his tale is one of coming to understand what his true calling was, what he was called to do. There were a number of different stages in this. He realized finally that it wasn't about physically building, repairing churches, but it was this more metaphorical notion of rebuilding the church, restructuring it, of taking it back to its foundation, which he did. And he is essentially one of the great reformers of Western Christendom. Took the Roman Catholic Church back to its very foundations. He was very devoted to Christ. He tried to live the example of Christ as laid out in the Gospels. He tried to live through the apostolic directions given in the New Testament for the disciples to go out and teach, to take no purse, to go forth and eat whatever was laid before you. If somebody stole your cloak, run after them and give them your coat as well. And he lived in this extreme state of simplicity and poverty. It seems like this should be grim. I mean, who wants to be poor? Sir Bishop Stephen Heller has said on many occasions, "I've been rich and I've been poor, and between the two, which is nicer?" Personally, I've been in both places as well, and I have to say it's nicer to be rich. But when you get to a certain level of poverty, you do encounter and experience what Francis was talking about, what he called true joy. And this is something that I experienced before I left Utah to go to California some years back, that when you really have nothing, you literally have nothing, you don't have any idea where your next meal is coming from, there is this extraordinary sense of liberation, lack of stress. It's almost a giddy feeling. Really relate to Francis and his just sheer exuberant joy that he felt. Because you are no longer stressed. You no longer have any of this planning as to what you're going to do next or worrying or all of these things. It's almost as if these muscles metaphorically that have been tightened in your body all your life suddenly relax. Wow, can be free from that. So amazing. And there is a true liberation that comes. And it is really joyful. It's a lot of fun. Probably better than any chemical high you can get. But it is paradoxical. As you get to this true joy by literally giving up everything and giving up control and being free from all of that. It's really odd. But this experience is what Francis obtained in his searching for his spiritual path and also offered to everyone else. And it was a very amazing experience that many people took him up on and joined him. There was a very early on followers of Francis, and this became the early Franciscan order. A lot of his ideas were so radical that he was under suspicion. This was a time not just of the Cathars, but also the Waldensians, Peter Waldo, a sect that also espoused poverty, but also pointed a finger at the church for its lack of poverty, for its being essentially lords of the earth. The bishop was like a baron, really. They were very similarly treated, addressed, had similar powers, income from land, and so forth. And there was a lot of money around. There was a whole lot of money in the church. And so Peter Waldo attacked that and espoused poverty. But Francis never attacked anybody. He was a very gentle soul. And he saw his way and offered it, but didn't insist that anyone else follow it. And so he was able to persuade the suspicious Pope, through the aid of some allies he won, his cardinal in particular, and get his first primitive rule tentatively approved. And his way of writing out a rule wasn't really to think about it and try to construct a system of these things. He just collected scriptures, references for how one should behave, and wrote them down, quotes entirely, offered that as his rule, and was told to revise it, expand it. This would become a major tension throughout the Franciscan movement from then on. He was given a little church, Church of the Angels, Church of Mary and the Angels. And this he rebuilt, refurbished, and this became the home church of the movement near Assisi. And there were many stories after his death that were collected by his followers. So many wonderful and paradoxical things. One of the stories talks about true joy, and brother was walking with Francis, and we were walking through some nasty weather. Said, we arrive back at the church, it's dark, and that won't be true joy. Arrive back at the church and it's dark, and we knock and knock and knock, and nobody responds. And that's not true joy either. Arrive back at the church and knock and knock and knock, and somebody says, who are you? And Francis, oh, you can't be, he's not around. And we're left standing there, then that is true joy. It's a lot of these almost Zen-like paradoxical things. But in having no expectations, no plans of what's going to occur, as a Buddhist would say, no attachments, he found true joy, found that freedom, that liberation, that light. And he was very infectiously joyous. Stories of him picking up sticks and playing them like a fiddle, and he considered his troop around him in many symbolic ways. One is his jongleurs, his jugglers, or fools of God, entertainers. Another one was as the knights of the round table. These are the knights. And these were, of course, people who didn't really even own the habits they wore. Stories of one of the brothers, Brother Juniper, who would often go off and come back naked because he'd given his rags to somebody who was worse off than he was. It's not even marginal existence, it's below marginal existence. And yet that joy and spirit informed it all and attracted so many people that the movement really exploded during Francis's life. And he essentially had to escape from his own movement, his own creation. Because they then had more people, and they argued over a rule that was less restrictive, that would allow the order to own this or that, or at least have rights to buildings and lands and so forth. And all this kind of group process work that made no sense to Francis. You know, this is the way for him. if you're going to do this, do it this way. Give up everything and have that joy. It wasn't that he was completely uncompromising, because he created other orders. He allowed Claire of Assisi, he actually assisted her in becoming a nun and declaring herself a nun, and founding an order of the Poor Clares. It's called the Second Order of Francis. And he also had another friend, was a woman, but he called brother anyway, who he founded a third order for people to live in the world with their families and their work, and still have that access to that spirit of Francis, the spirit that he found and encountered and experienced and shared, to still aim for those virtues, even though you weren't living in a very restricted way. You weren't giving up everything, literally, physically, but you would focus on the same aspects of spirituality, same foundations, same experience, and following the example of Christ. And so that really expanded as well. And you can find Francis quite literally in almost every Christian denomination. Will revere Francis. There are Franciscan orders in many different denominations as well. It's not just a Roman Catholic thing. He is a great inspirer that shaped Western Christendom, not just Roman Catholicism. His focus was on the reality of the situation, on the experience of the spiritual life. He didn't give up everything on a whim or based on an idea or a theological premise or a dogma, but he was led that way through visions, through dreams, his own calling. And he found it through his own experience. He found the true joy by giving up everything. He's a very pragmatic saint. His rules for brothers who were on retreat show that he also understood the mystical elements and wanted to nurture those. He allowed in his rule for two brothers to go off, one to remain in private contemplation away from the world, while the other one took care of the necessities of going out and begging for food, and the one who was out begging would bring back and share what he had gotten during the day. And the brother who had spent the day in prayer and contemplation would share with his brother what he had gotten from the day. So there was this sharing of the inner and the outer, and both were of equal, if not more, value. There is such a level of conscious understanding. And we see figures that are thought of as saints or as even magical qualities, magicians or other figures, that a lot of this sort of aura surrounding them came from their difference not in the physical abilities, but their difference in consciousness. We might today call both consciousness and wisdom. To be able to see a problem from a new perspective and solve it because they're coming in with a much different understanding of the world. This is late Middle Ages, late medieval, late Dark Ages, really. About to shift from the influence of the Cathars, the influence of the troubadours, the influence of hermetic thought returning, but still at the end of this very dark period, and a figure who was awake, who was conscious, could come into a new situation and like solve the problem with simplicity and seem magical, holy, amazing. And it comes to mind as the Wolf of Gubbio, I think it is. This is one of the tales told about Francis, that he went to a village where they were being plagued with a wolf. Small children were essentially picked off when they were alone, carried off and killed and eaten by this wolf. And whatever villagers tried to do, to try to hunt it down, try to get it, was failing. And he passed through, they turned to him for help. The story goes that he then went up and talked to the wolf and made a deal that the villagers would provide the wolf with food and the wolf wouldn't bother the villagers anymore. Well, we look at it a little more, let's say, realistically. Probably was a very simple issue for Francis. But, hey, wolf, if he's hunting children, he's very hungry. If you feed him, he's going to eat it, and he isn't going to come after anybody. It's difficult for a wolf to try to get humans. It's dangerous. It's really a last desperate resort. And like any other creature, including humans, why do more effort than you have to? Call it laziness or conserving resources, depending on whether we want to be negative or positive about it, but that's just the way everything works. And it's a very simple solution. feed the wolf, you're safe. And this village then did that, and they were, it's a miracle. It's a miracle what Francis does. Now, many of these kind of miraculous acts are that being tied into reality at a higher level of consciousness and understanding than perhaps everyone around you. And in simpler ages, doing that was seen as amazing. It's amazing people. Today we're more cynical. Don't want them to be amazing. That impedes on our own egocentric view of ourselves and the world. But it's still pretty amazing when you have somebody who sees something from such a different perspective that it's simple now. The problem that seemed untenable is now simple. Call them geniuses now, not saints. But same concept. The collect for today being the 18th Sunday after Trinity, this is commemoration of the saints. That the saints are the revealers of reality, it says. That reason to pay attention to saints, because their example, their understanding of things, is something we can benefit from. Particularly a saint such as Saint Francis, who held on to his understanding of reality, to his gnosis, despite what the world was telling him. The world tells you, in fact, most your instincts tell you, accumulating wealth, good. Giving things away, it may be good if you expect something back in return later on. More power, good. Giving away power, not good at all, ever. And instead of following these patterns and ways in the world, he followed his spiritual direction. He followed his gnosis, and he grew in that. He really was a pioneer for his age, even though what he ended up essentially pulling out of the dust of history was the living Christ, was his devotion to a living Christ, a living presence. Indeed, at the end of Francis's life, he so wanted to have that following the example of Christ, have the same experience of Christ, have the same gnosis, in some ways, of Christ. But first, being a medieval fellow in Roman Catholic context, saw this more physically. So he was the first saint to display stigmata. And this has been shown as a sometimes suspect, but it is a phenomenon that's cropped up from time to time throughout history thereafter. The one part of Francis' stigmata that I always found really odd was, or perhaps revealing, was an account that talked about somebody touching the nail that was in his foot. So maybe there were nails in his hand and feet, and that was why there were stigmata. But whatever it was, whether it was such a deep devotion that these wounds he had never healed or something, who knows? I think there are limits to mind over matter, mind over body, but they're not usually the limits we as a secular society lay out as the law. A little bit more flexible, but not like it's all unreal or doesn't follow physical laws. So, who knows? But at the end of his life, he went off a mountain, had a very powerful experience. A very powerful experience, in which he, in a sense, merged with Christ in a way. And the stigmata were then this way of showing that. And this idea that we could, as human beings, follow the path of Christ, was quite novel at that time. Subsequently, there were some other treatments of this, a famous Imitation of Christ by Kempis. But at this point, that whole inner experience, that whole inner life, had largely been lost through the Dark Ages, only been brought back by the Cathars, the Troubadours, and then later Hermetic influences. So he really was at a turning point of this culture, and his focusing on the real experience, following the real experience where it led him, brought about tremendous change in the world. He also focused on peace. He was a jongleur, a knight also, in his way, self-mocking but also serious, a knight of peace. It's said that he traveled to the Holy Land to broker a deal with the Muslims. This is during the Crusades. And he went there unarmed, walked into the Muslim camp, and was received and listened to, and much to the delight of the Sultan who received him, said, and then sent on his way. Well, you're such an amusing fellow, you know. But he had that complete lack of attachment or expectation that he just wandered into a war zone. And perhaps if the Sultan had been able to see in the same way that Francis saw, Of course, his Holland side would have to have been able to see as well. The conflict would have ended. But one can only present these possibilities. You can't actually transform another person. And transforming a whole group of people, really tricky if possible. So he moved for peace, and it is as a figure of peace, as a figure who really respected and had a great love of animals that he's primarily known for now. See him in gardens, here and there. On his day is the blessing of the animals, so if you drive past churches, there might be people with their dogs outside getting blessed. And this is all part of his connection with living things, with the whole of creation. It's very much a visceral, very much a gnosis. He knew these things. And his hymn of creation shows that. He saw them, you know, brother sun, sister moon, sister water, sister death. That there was this deep connection with all things. They weren't separated far off. One was always in a relationship with them. They were part of one's experience and one's world. So at his death, St. Francis, there was almost a war or some fighting over the corpse. Who would get to have this prestigious saint understood to be a saint in his own lifetime, because he would then be a focus of pilgrimage to go to where he was buried. This was economics. This is money. And he ended up being taken into Assisi and being entombed there in a somewhat ugly structure now, but with lots of beautiful paintings inside. One of the paintings shows this experience of Francis on the mountain receiving the stigmata. And on it, you see this figure of crucified Christ as a visionary figure, and Francis with his arms out. And there are lines from the stigmata of Christ to the stigmata of Francis, to all the wounds. And that visualizes that deep connection he had, that deep love and connection that he brought back. There's also a legend, shall we say, a story that was circulated after his life. It said that the world had grown so wicked that God had decided to destroy it again, much like in the story of Noah and the flood. But that Jesus and his mother Mary offered to go back down and reform the world again, save the world. And that Francis and Claire were essentially these reincarnations of Jesus and Mary. That for the people, their identity was the same as well. This would be considered rank heresy by a theologian. But it shows the spirit in which the people understood and received Francis after his death. And now he is a universal saint, so he is our saint as well. Never espoused a Gnostic doctrine that I'm aware of, except for this understanding of Gnosis itself, which is the main Gnostic doctrine, and this following of his spiritual experience and spiritual life. This will lead one, if pursued, to a deep understanding and to liberation, regardless of whether you have any Gnostic supposed doctrines associated with it at all, or any myths or stories that are specifically Gnostic. It's the Gnostic attitude, the attitude to Gnosis as salvific, as redemptive, that is the path of Gnosis. And Francis, in his way, followed that to this liberating joy, followed it through to an identification with Christ, that was so complete. And we, regardless of the fact that these things are understood physically by the people of the time, and are understood physically by most people now, and see that as a story that we can relate to, that we follow the path of Gnosis, that we follow our own spiritual development and growth. We seek the light, we seek liberation. And we do so following the example of Christ, following the teachings, trying to become more Christ-like ourselves. Not an image of Christ, but having the gnosis of Christ. And having these images lead us further and further towards light, life, liberation. And so Francis becomes for us a living symbol, what is possible for us. That core of gnosis. So many other things. It's an example of an aspect of reality. Gnostics are often quite poor. Sir Bishop, half serious, half jokingly, has been known to say Gnostics don't have to take a vow of poverty. We usually have it thrust upon us anyways, isn't required to declare it. But being separate from the ways of the world and the values of the world offers that kind of freedom, offers that ability to focus on what is real, to not compromise that focus, to have that liberation, to follow the spiritual. And that is what all of the saints represent. People who hold on to the real, to the spirit, follow their own gnosis, and attain something. And we can learn from all of them to do that, to hold on to what is real. Because that is the path, and that is the way to liberation. No shining, glittering, gilded illusion can ever satisfy. No amount of gathering together physical resources will work as a strategy to liberation or joy. The story of the foolish farmer who gathers all of his crops and then says, well, I'm going to lend money at interest and I'll be building barns and so forth, and then he dies. He can't have a defense against reality through wealth. And so having that hold on reality and that transcendent hold, which one is not with mere physical, mere material, that includes the spiritual, the life of the spirit, the light beyond the world. With that, one has the great treasure that is there. The Manichaean tradition talks about the great treasure that we are. If we have that, we have ourselves. And within ourselves is that divine spark that is mysteriously a part of the highest divinity. So having that freedom, having that life, is a way. If we are a slave, it doesn't matter how many resources we have at our disposal, how much wealth or whatever, but we don't own ourselves, we don't control our own destiny. If we're poor and free, we do control our own destiny. And this is what Franciscan True Joy essentially is about. The joy that comes from truly following one's spiritual path, where that comes from. So let us, as we follow our own spiritual calling, follow our own path, look to the examples of the saints that include that of saints who aren't necessarily identifiably Gnostic, but who have followed their own spiritual calling, their own gnosis, such as Francis of Assisi. Learn from that. Gain from that. Allow ourselves to become more ourselves by seeing how they became more themselves, more liberated, manifested the spirit in the world. It's the mystery that which hangs strict heaven and earth, and upon us, remain with us all. For more information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG. And the Gnosis Institute at gnosisinstitute.org. If you'd like to continue receiving these podcasts, please consider a voluntary subscription of either $13 or $25 a year. That's $1 to $2 a month to make it possible to continue to provide this service. Thank you.